Welcome to Holyrood Ungagged, the Mr. O'Malley, a political podcast. Season 3, episode 11, and also happens to be Brian's final episode recording with us as a permanent contributor. Is that what we call these?
Yeah.
I know I'm the host. I'm your host, David McClement, transmitting from the Blantyre Free State. And it's not just Brian, the Pizza Hut Prince, that is with us. We also get Deborah, who's feeling a bit under the weather, but she's soldiering on and with us, as she's always with us, Deborah Torrance. How are you, Deborah? Brian, how's things?
Good, hiya.
Hello, hello.
I'm sad it's Brian's last episode.
Mm-hmm. Is it, I feel like it's come around quite quickly, actually, because we had a discussion about, I don't know, 5-6 weeks ago, something like that, and it's come around really quickly, so... And obviously, in fact, I've been on holiday twice during that time.
That's what I was going to say. I'm not that fussed. He's always on holiday anyway. So,
actually, that's there's truth in that.
We'll be halfway through season 4 and we'll be like, when is Brian getting back from his holidays? He's not still in Spain, is he? Where is he now?
Listen, we had hundreds of flights left over from the pandemic that we just kept moving and kept moving. And then in my workplace that I was working in just now, it's like, hey, can you just send us your holiday request? And I was like, well, here you go. Yeah, so that's why that is.
There was a woman in my work that used to really annoy everybody else because she would immediately put in her holiday requests. But then when those dates came up closer, she would cancel half of them. She would just put them in as like a placeholder. And then she'd decide, actually, no, I don't need them. And then she'd withdraw the holiday request and put it in some other time.
That's so not cool.
So some people were used to get a bit annoyed by that, which I can understand.
Annual leave management, terrible, terrible time.
I never get people that end up not using their annual leave.
Oh,
I don't get the mentality when I have to remind somebody to take their holiday. And I'm like, I've had mine in for about 3 months.
Mine's, I'm the person that has all my holidays booked, like at least a year in advance, normally. All sorted, all organised. Annual leave in, so I'm like, just look forward to my time off. I ken what I'm doing. But that woman cancelling holidays last minute and potentially blocking somebody from getting their holidays is just...
No nice.
There's not much solidarity in that, is there?
That is not. Anyway, for the final time with Brian, let's get ungagged.
Woo! Dream a dream cause you'll never die. Stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice, nice to hear you smile.
Okay, first item on the agenda this evening. A group in Tayside has defended its decision to appoint a man as a period dignity officer. Jason Grant's hiring sparked a heated online debate, critics saying the job should have gone to a woman. He will work with the area's period dignity working group to implement the legal right to free period products in public setting. The working group has representatives from Dundee and Angus College, Perth College, Angus Council and Dundee City Council. And they all said that Mr. Grant was the strongest candidate for the job. I feel as if I have to go to you first, Deborah, as the only woman in the 3 years. It might have been better if this had come up last week when we had a majority female panel, but... We can't organise these things, obviously.
I don't care. I don't care that it's a guy. I know I'm probably a terrible feminist for saying so, but it's a legislative role. It's just managing the rollout. I don't care. It could have been a woman, possibly, but I went and read the job description. It sounds boring, so I'm not surprised the man's saying it. Honestly, I couldn't care less. Sorry.
Right, so
I'll just find something else to talk about then.
Thanks for joining us. See you later.
I just mean, I don't care that it's a guy. I understand that folk are very upset about this. And that was there a woman that could do the role? I'm pretty sure if there was, she would have got the job. But she didn't. It was this guy, and he seems to be a sort of motivational sports person into health anyway. So maybe that's... the sort of team leader that is needed to roll out free sanitary products. I mean, it's great. We've got that. That's what it's about, isn't it? He's meant to be the period czar. Although that isn't his job title, by the way. That just seems to be one that's been given to him, a czar. Does anybody want to be a Zara period?
A period Zara. It sounds like you're talking about a period of time. Period Zara. Yeah, that's what, just leading up to 1917, I believe. Brian, what was your thoughts on this?
My thoughts were that was a terrible joke. because I kind of missed the sort of Twitter outrage about this one. I don't know if I was just not paying attention or not on Twitter. I tend to take a couple of days off Twitter and these things seem to pass relatively quickly. So I went and done some reading about it and I was just a bit like, what's the problem here? Like, I understand, like, and oh, you know, so many people are going to be like, ah, my goodness. You know, do I think that a woman should be on a roll like that? And do I think that those who have periods should be at the forefront of bringing about legal change, policy change, advocacy, all these different things? Absolutely, yes. But this is more, seem, to me, doesn't quite seem like it's that. It seems to me that, like, almost like what you were saying, Deborah, it's like it's more of a legislative role, administrative role, all these different things. So, you know, and I was quite surprised because when I was settling on how I was going to approach the subject, how I was going to discuss the subject, I was a bit like, but I mean, it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter. However, like I'm saying, when it comes to the activism, when it comes to discussing the issues around period poverty, all these different things, the voices of women and those who have periods, those from working class backgrounds, those who from different minority groups, these are the really important times where these voices need to be elevated and listened to and entrenched into legislation. And it seems like where we are in Scotland at the moment, that part has happened, and that is a positive thing. And I'm sure there'll be reflections on how that could have been improved, and, you know, in the next sort of round of debates around period poverty and around poverty more generally. So that seems to me where the kind of biggest opportunities are when it comes to bringing around these changes. But to me, I think that from what I can gather, and again, I'm only going back to this like after the sort of excitement on Twitter has ended, that to me, I can't see this being such a huge issue. But would it be better to have a woman or someone who has a period in that role? Absolutely. But the four key stakeholders have said that this is the best person for the job. So probably better for them to decide rather than us just sort of giving people job title names and trying to make this into an issue when actually the key stakeholders have said this is the best person to do it. So maybe we should just let him get on with it and perhaps for him to stop and reflect on how he can include the voices of marginalised women in the work that he's going to be doing. Then I think that's probably the best outcome.
I mean, I actually think in some ways it's quite good that they picked a man for the job. We have such a weird cultural thing around periods and menstruation, and, you know, it's treated like as if it's some kind of dirty secret. You know, like, generally most men, until they're probably an embarrassing age, don't really understand what they are at all, because it's never spoken about in front of men even, and it's even when it is, it's like, you know, in hushed tones, as if don't ask questions. And, you know, as a father of three daughters, I kind of will, it's probably quite good if I understand what it is, and the fact that I was probably about 30 or 25 or something before I ever had a proper idea of what it involved and things like that. And I think it's so weird, the kind of cultural hang-up. And like I said, I think a lot of men, it's complete ignorance ignorance in the true sense of just not understanding and not knowing. A lot of this is perpetuated by women, and I think maybe it's a generational thing. Some older women are treat it as if it's something kind of shameful that isn't to be spoken about, isn't to be discussed. So I don't think it's a big deal either way, but I think in some ways it opens up a discussion about, and that's quite a point in my mind.
I think there's a real cultural throwback to sort of medieval times, and not so much medieval times. There's still, in some communities across the world, such a thing as a period hut, where young women and menses get sent into isolation because it's so dirty and filthy. And part of the whole medieval church system, women were dirty. You know what I mean? Like the whole misogynist campaign and witchcraft and all the rest of it. Anyway, that's going down a different avenue, as I tend to do when my brain doesn't work. I don't care, it's a guy. Just emphasize that point one more time. I don't care what gender the person is, it's whether they do a good job or not. And it's a great point you made, Brian, about elevating the voices of marginalized people who have periods, because I think that's going to be what his job is. Like, So power to him. I hope he does one of the period cramp simulators, though. I think all guys should have a go.
Oh, thank you.
But the thing is, like you were saying there, just about the misogyny as well, and kind of tying in what David was saying, it's like, you know, the sort of like dirty secret of people not discussing periods and not talking about these different things about menstruation and understanding, you know, all these different things around it. And you know, sex education, whilst I was at school, was very much separate. So it was like done by gender. The boys will go and talk about this and the girls will go and talk about that. So there was no real communication, you know, to those who were classed as boys at that time about menstruation. So it's just, yeah, I think there just needs to be a kind of bit of a cultural reset about how we discuss periods, how we carry these things forward. And it's a great piece of legislation that Scotland could be really proud of, that we have got access to products that those who have periods need. And it's something that we should all collectively be really proud of. And we should give as much power as we can to these people who are going to be carrying it forward in a sort of legislative role. So good luck to everybody who's going to be taking on roles like this. And it's a real huge opportunity for us to have that cultural reset that we need, like we've had in some aspects about LGBT inclusive in education in schools, that this could also be that sort of moment where there's a bit of a turn in the corner and to make the change that's very much needed.
You know, I remember a kind of story from, I worked in a residential unit, and it was kind of like maybe 65%, like two-thirds women staff to men, and one of the female staff raised this concern, because she said she had to go into one of the female resident rooms, and I think somebody should talk to her because she's leaving tampons lying about, and because some of the male staff might have to go in there. And we were kind of like half nodding, and then one of the guys said, so if they use tampons? And she went, oh no, they're just in the packet. And all the guys looked at each other as if, why would we be upset about like seeing something in a packet? You know, like, it just seemed so strange. And again, most of the women were all nodding along, complete agreement, the idea that any man would see a tampon. A package tampon so strange, was sort of something to be discussed at a meeting and a point of concern to address with the person. I found it so strange, and that's what I've been thinking about that story all week since I read this article.
I definitely think it's a generational thing, because Jeannie wouldn't let me use tampons as a teenager. She said virgins can't use. So I think that it was a definite taboo around it. There was still a taboo around it when I was young as well. Like, if you got caught short and had to ask the school office, they'd be, oh, yes, do it like a drug deal across the school office, you know, through the wee window.
It's just, you know, thinking back to these things, it's just...
Yeah. And the thing is, most male teachers would have zero clue how even if somebody with the best will in the world wanted to be supportive and help, I think they would genuinely, certainly back then, not have a clue how to help a female student in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that help anybody?
So I think the whole free sanitary products is you know, it's an accessible thing. It's I wish it was there when I was at school and college. It certainly would have helped me out a few times. And since I think one of the first places I've seen it happening before it was actual legislation was at the, I forget the name of the pub, but it's at like an inn in Aberfoyle, and when you go in, the ladies, they always had sanitary products available, and it's useful. That's the only thing I can really say.
And, well, and
when the whole debate about free sanitary products came up, I can't remember where I first heard it, but it was when somebody likened it to toilet paper. And you're like, of course, you would not have a debate about whether we should have toilet paper in public toilets or in your work toilet. You know, this idea that, if you want to wipe your arse, you make sure you get toilet paper with you. You know, properly prepare. You're like, what is the big deal here? Just, can we not just, it's something that is needed and provide that need.
And one of the first times that I came across this was in the Rad Apple in Dundee, ironically, which was a really positive thing, is seeing products for periods in the men's toilets. So I think it's a really, really important thing. So it's trans inclusive for those who are non-binary, who chose, or genderqueer, that choose to use men's toilets. That it's about this complete cultural shift now, where, you know, people need access to these products. So they should be provided, and they should be available to someone, like you say, if you get caught short. And it's almost like, you know, those who have periods have to carry these, you know, products around with them just in case, you know. And it just, we wouldn't expect anybody else, you know, if it was something that wasn't specifically for women or those who have periods to manage, then, you know, like the toilet paper situation, it's like, you know, we wouldn't expect people to carry toilet paper around with them. So it's good to see that it's been rolled out, and it's something for us to be really proud of. But one thing that I will say for the next step when it comes to, you know, period poverty and dealing with periods more broadly, is in the workplace and some of the health conditions that come with women who and those who have periods, who really struggle with pain and things like that during their period, and allowances for time off and things like that. So that, I think this will actually be the next step in this, because it's fascinating just from the kind of work that I've been doing and the kind of research that some of my colleagues are doing, that there's so many women who are present at work that don't feel that they're well enough to be present at work. So I think now that's the kind of next step forward. So okay, now we've got the basics in place for period poverty, which is fantastic, and now let's start addressing the other areas of inequality when it comes to with those who have periods.
Yeah, I don't know if you can imagine having a cramp so bad that it makes you feel sick and mm-hmm. just
yeah
once a month, every month. Hey, can I tell you a wee period joke? Because there's not many opportunities I get to tell you jokes mm-hmm. about periods. When I was wee, and you were talking about it a wee minute ago, Brian, when you have the classrooms, you get split up into girls and boys and get the talk. Mm-hmm. And the lady asked, does anybody have any questions? I had a lot of fucking questions. But I only asked one, and I said, how long do your periods last for? And the lady said, 5 days, about 5 days. And I was so ecstatic, and you can understand my shock and horror when I heard about they last until your 40s. So what? I was told 5 days. I was told it was a 5-day event.
Not 5 days every month.
That was missed it.
I do remember
the first time I heard periods mentioned, and I was at high school, and it was some girl was off sick, and somebody said, oh, she got her period, and I went, all right, and I had absolutely no idea what the hell they were talking about. You know, when you're like 13, you don't admit to no knowing anything. Mm-hmm. You're just like, all right, aye, of course. Not a clue. I genuinely don't know what age I was when I actually felt as if I had a proper understanding of it.
This is the thing when it comes to sex education in general and high school or anything to do with puberty was just the most confusing time ever. You know, when it's like they start talking about periods, everyone's confused, and then they start talking about wet dreams, and you think, what on earth is a wet dream? Where are we going with this? It's just bizarre.
I was going to say something there, you mentioned wet dreams, and that just wiped everything out of my brain. It was, oh, okay, our next item in the agenda. Glasgow museums have agreed to return 7 stolen artefacts to India. Delegates from the Indian High Commission sealed the move by signing an agreement at the Kelvin Grove Art Gallery and Museum. It's thought to be the first repatriation to India from a UK museum, with more to follow elsewhere. 6 of the items, including a 14th century carvings and 11th century stone door jams, were stolen from shrines and temples in the 19th century. The 7th object was a ceremonial sword. It was stolen in 1905 from the collection of Nizam of Hyderabad by his prime minister and sold to British general Sir Archibald Hunter, and all of the items were then gifted to Glasgow Museum. Brian,
this thoughts? Is a good thing. No, I think this is just a really positive thing, and there started to be a bit of a wave of this more broadly with especially some culprits like the British Museum, who famously get ridiculed constantly for stealing things. I mean, historically, artifacts from across the world, particularly from colonies, were basically just taken, and then rather than being returned or you know, being made accessible, they're just popped into British museums and made to be these fantastic, you know, spectacles to come and see. You know, it just, when you think about it in that scale, it's just horrendous. And you know, if you've got all these different artifacts, I mean, for some aspects it's religious artifacts, some, you know, highly cultural artifacts, some extremely old artifacts, so they shouldn't be, you know, either part of any private collections specifically. They shouldn't be held, you know, in a museum in a country that was part of the British Empire, which was culpable for the removal of so many of these artifacts. So absolutely, these items should be returned to where they came from. I mean, there was, when I was doing some reading about this story, there's another one recent about the British Museum as well. It's artifacts for the Benin by British soldiers. So this is like loads and loads of historical bronzes, which are, you know, several thousand years old, and they're being returned to which was Benin, which is now a state in Nigeria. So these sorts of cases seem to be coming up a lot more often. It's great that these discussions are being taken more seriously. I think from what I remember, you know, even 10 years ago, that this would be quite a fringe conversation. It would be very much like perhaps painted by centrists and people on the right as, you know, woke and, you know, people just creating problems where there isn't any problems. But actually now it's good to see these institutions take their responsibility a little bit more seriously and start to return these artifacts to the states that should have them in their possession.
Deborah?
Yeah. Do you remember the spirit shirt that was in Kelvin Grove? I mind when I was wee, we went to see it, and then that was returned to the Lakota, and that was hailed as this big brilliant thing. But what upset me was, what about all the other stuff? So when you actually think about the British Museum, it is founded on the plundering colonial states. That's, they are not just colonial states, like every country in the world, they've robbed something and they've got it on display. It is definitely the right move, but I want to ask, who takes a war off a shrine? Mm-hmm. Like, who even thinks, you know what, that'll look good in my stately home? What was that about?
Well,
how did they get it?
When I was reading about this, it was it reminded me of an old joke that I heard once about, it says, why are the pyramids in Egypt? Because the British couldn't get them on the boat. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's like. I mean, they just strip mine places. They just took anything that they thought would have any value.
Yeah. Talking about Egypt, there's many artifacts that were stolen and plundered that can't be returned, particularly mummies, human remains that were ground up and snorted by Victorians. I mean, that is where this whole thing began. They don't care about human remains, are not going to care about artifacts. That it's gross. It makes me annoyed. But it's like the zoo theory as well. That flip side of, if we didn't have these things, would children still be able to get that interested and involved in it? Like, if we didn't have the museums, would our, like, especially in Glasgow where there's so many free exhibits. As a child, that was our day out, going to free museums, People's Palace, going to Kelvin Grove. And without that, I don't know if I would have such a love for history. But then I think about it, it's 2022 and we have the internet. So get everything back to the people, repatriate everything.
Also, you can have something in your museum without having stole it.
Exactly.
You can have it on loan. You can have a replica made as well, which, you know, is quite a common thing, which is absolutely fine. And, you know, and it's true what you're saying. It's like, you know, for me as well, when I was younger, a lot of these sort of free exhibits and things like that were days out. And before the Act was brought in, like, even some of the museums in and around Falkirk were really cheap as well before they were free, which was great. And you learn so much about, you know, different aspects of history and different countries and cultures. And it's such an interesting, especially when you're younger, because your mind's just, you know, popping away and you want to understand things. But we don't need to steal the artifact from India or from Nigeria or from any other country. We can create replicas. We can critically talk about history as well, which is, I think, is particularly important, because, you know, some of the wording that's used in museums, when you read the, you know, the little plaques, and it's almost like as if it just magically appeared here. The history, if we want to learn the history of these artifacts, we want to learn the history of how we ended up stealing it in the first place and how it ended up in the British Museum or you know, in someone's private collection that was then gifted to another museum. I think the actual history of the item is really important, but actually the history of the essentially the upper classes, of how they can have these items and then be in a position to gift them to certain places, to me is just wild. And I think that these types of things are just as important as the history of the items themselves.
I mean, it is pretty hard, I think, for these institutions to justify now. I think that's why we're seeing moves, because, I mean, what proper justification can you have except, but we've had it for ages. That's really what it boils down to. Mm-hmm. But you admit it was stolen. Yeah, but it was stolen ages ago, you know. So just leave it. That's basically their best argument. They have nothing. That's it. That's all they've got to say. If you say, why don't you give people back the stuff that was stolen from them? And there's nothing. There's no good reasonable argument for not doing it. Yeah, and what really it boils down to now is, again, delaying tactics to, like, you know, obviously check to make sure it's going back to the right place and all that, because God forbid somebody should have it that had no right to it, you know? Even though that's been the case since 1905 in the case of this ceremonial sword.
Do you think the Queen will give back her big Indian gem?
Oh, that's a good one.
I'm not going to hold my breath.
It'd be nice if they asked for it, though.
I think they should. India, ask.
Just for bants, if nothing else.
It's like, India, go and ask Lizzie for that gem back.
See that, Corey Noor, you done with it. I don't know why I done a Fife accent there, sorry.
It worked.
You know, talking about your Fife accent, really funny. Side note, bit of light relief for the podcast. Chatting about drag queen names, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine actually having a drag queen called Michelle Pfeiffer, but it's spelled Pfeiffer, and the character is a Pfeiffer. Michelle Pfeiffer.
Ryan, you need to do it.
It just came to me in a dream, and I was like, Glenn, what about this? And I just think it's great.
And does Glenn just look around and go, right, I'll add it to the list, Brian?
Basically, yeah. Because, you know, there is a list, but, you know, it's a good one. It's on the list.
Can I suggest the slight change and change it to Big Shell Pfeiffer?
I love it.
How did we get here for a plundered ceremonial song?
This is Hollywood. This is what it is. This is what happens. This is what happens when we're actually in the same room talking to each other.
I feel as if I've run out of things to talk about, because there really isn't much to say beyond it's good that they're giving back the stuff they stole.
This is like basics of right and wrong.
Yeah.
What else do you say to that?
Give it back quickly.
Except there is so much still in museums that you're talking about that is clearly stolen. I mean, did they ever give back the Elgin marble? Like, I felt as if that popped up every few years, but it was like, going to use the Elgin marbles back, and they were like, nah.
Elgin marbles?
You know, heard of the Elgin marble? Brian, is this just me?
No, I don't know a lot about them, but like you, well, it pops up every few years, and I did read about this in my research for this particular topic.
Well, when I was younger, I remember it in the news, and I did think it was marbles, as in like a wee pouch of marbles.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what are they making a big deal about it? Some marbles for? Turns out, no, it's like a collection of like marble statues, like loads mm-hmm. of them, and they're called Elgin, because that was the name of the guy that stole them.
Yeah.
So not only did they steal these, they then, you know, have named them after the guy that stole them from Greece back in the day.
Wow.
But I can't remember. In your research, did they say whether they were back? Because I feel as if they might have been, but...
I don't think they were. Hang on, let me just double check.
Fact checker Brian's on it.
Fact checker, has the Elgin marbles finally made it back? Have they been, A, renamed, B, have they, where they need to go?
I would think the Greek people never called them Elgin marbles.
No, I don't think...
No, I can't find anything in my hand.
If Jimmy down the road stole my telly, I wouldn't start referring to it as Jimmy's telly.
No.
Can I get Jimmy's telly back?
I like Brian's searching face. That's going to be his face for the next year at least.
It's my research face.
That's his PhD face.
That's not the PhD face.
That's his doctor face.
That's the crying face. Yeah, they're, I believe they're still in the British Museum.
Wow. Give them back to Greece.
They really have been asking them back for a long time. I'm actually really surprised. I thought, because like I said, what is your excuse? What is your excuse for not giving back something that has been, everybody knows, was stolen?
They want to verify the Grecian gods are in fact Greek.
Then we need to verify that Greece is Greece. And we need to get the right flight. We need to check that, you know? So that will take another 30, 40 years.
Alright, so basically the conclusion is, can everybody stop stealing stuff? Can the rich folk stop trying to claim things and renaming things? And can we just give things back to where they come from? And if people start saying, oh, but like our museums will be empty, good. Like, well, let's just, replicas, educational, internet access, make them free right across the board, so everybody can get excited about history, but maybe get excited about history and learn about the more recent history of how rich folks started stealing things and the British Empire. And let's learn about all history, not just the selective niceties.
And for God's sake, stop snorting Egyptian mummies.
Oh, and can just leave Just leave human remains as well. Like, the mummy thing really bugs me.
I read about that as well. There was also
a euphemism of any sort.
There was also a case where they had a human head. I think it was a Maori head. And it was literally a guy was like, that's my great grandfather. Can we get his head back? And they're like, sure, of course. And the other issue is like, is it appropriate to display a human head? Like, because that was a person and this guy did have a family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine going to a museum and seeing your great granddad's head sitting on a shelf.
There was a exhibition when I was down in London, and it was basically like advertises all these skeletons that had like issues and that they had been discovered across different places and right across the world and things like that. And I remember reading about it thinking, how do we think that's okay? Like, these are people. Like, is it human remains? So we're just going to plonk them on, you know, in this room, and everybody can pay money to go and look at them. I mean, because there were some cases of somebody, and I remember reading about a specific one of somebody who had died of syphilis, and basically that there was a problem with the skeleton because of it, and, you know, there were certain breaks in the skeleton, and the skull had, you know, there were certain things that happened to the skull and whatnot. And I was like, why are we showing all this? Like, okay, we understand the medical history, we understand, you know, how these different things were problematic for different reasons. We don't need to see the skeleton laid out, you know, that was somebody who died clearly in quite traumatic circumstances, and we just think it's okay to raise money, you know, for private collectors because of these skeletons. It's just the human remains thing, and ultimately animal remains as well, similarly to me personally, I just don't think is appropriate. And so we shouldn't be stealing artifacts, we shouldn't be stealing folk, and we shouldn't be stealing animals either. So
you're not into the taxidermy?
Absolutely not. Even just on a basic level, that I find it terrifying, but I'm not really into that now.
See, I think it's an amazing art though. Like, it's a real skill to do good taxidermy. I wouldn't kill an animal to stuff it, but if I find a good roadkill, why would you? There's a woman that she taxidermies little mice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen it. And she puts them in really beautiful, I can see David smirk because he knows how much this is annoying Brian. And she puts them in amazing little poses, like in wee teacups. And it's beautiful, but she doesn't kill the mice. She just finds dead mice and makes them beautiful.
The reason I was smarting is I just get a fantastic scenario through my head, and it's FBI agent Deborah Torrance with the rest of her team discovering Ed Gein, the serial killer. And she's like, I mean, all right, the suit is made of human skin, but look at the stitches in that. Look at the stitches.
What an art form.
That is quality handiwork there.
I really appreciate
handmade
goods. That'll
last for years, that. You can wear that for years. The wear you get out of it.
Yeah, that
you made me sound really sick, kid. I wasn't talking about human skin shit, man. That's warped. I'm just saying taxidermy is a real art.
No, I just think you're a positive person who can see the best in the situation.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's
no.
Human skin jacket?
A human skin suit, but... Look at the workmanship. Look at
that's
going to
be water. That's waterproof. That is.
Say that.
You can wear that in any weather.
Mm-hmm.
Any weather.
It is the score.
I did actually also think a serious point, because when we talk about the British Empire and you talk and things like reparations come up, you know, when people try to dismiss it and say, "Look, how can you? Look, you know, I never worked with that. You know, this was generations ago, decades ago. You can't really expect to pay back for stuff that happened." So long ago, when you think, well, no, people are still making money out of the benefits of the empire. You know, all these museums, these institutions are still benefiting out of the fact that the British Empire plundered the world.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that they can still make money out of that, but the idea of reparations is wrong because it's too long ago or it's away in the past, this is past?
I think, yeah. And on that point as well, that, you know, we can talk about all these countries that were part of and still part of either what was then the British Empire and the Commonwealth, and I say that in inverted commas, that how much they were actually held back by so many aspects of colonialism and the repatriation, not only just of artifacts, but, you know, the discussions around repatriation of wealth, repatriation yeah. of all these different things. And this is a really complex discussion, and I'm not prepared for it because I was not expecting this left turn out of this particular topic area. But it's about, we should really be listening to the experts from these countries specifically, and from these minorities, that, you know, because Britain has benefited historically from the British Empire, from the resources from these countries, from the people of these countries under various different forms, that it's almost impossible to know exactly the value, like to put a value on that, of how much, you know, all of these actions had benefited Britain and how it made it such a you know, such a rich country. So we absolutely should be having these wider discussions around repatriation and really start to be supporting these countries to ultimately, from an economic point of view, to benefit them and to support them because of how much damage we caused in the past.
Absolutely.
But that was a completely off script discussion that I just had there. So if there's any holes in that, apologies.
That's all right. The human skin jacket kind of threw me in.
Absolutely did.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures. From snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles, Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
Welcome back. This topic, just to give a wee glimpse behind the curtain of how we work here at Holyrood Ungagged. Me as a host, I kind of get the subjects together and I send them out to Brian and Deborah, and they usually go, yeah, that's a good idea, or they'll suggest something else. I didn't want to talk about this because I felt as if we covered it quite well a while ago, but Deborah and Brian were determined that we had to talk about shite.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are talking about shite. Water companies are facing mounting criticism from environmental campaigners and politicians over sewage being pumped onto British beaches. Pollution warnings remain in place across more than 20 beaches and swimming spots in England and Wales after heavy rain overwhelmed the sewers. At the height of the recent problems, there were warnings in places in more than 40 locations. Environmental campaigner Virgil Sharkey said issues with sewage showed the water industry when it was in a state of chaos and blamed decades of regulatory failure, underinvestment and profiteering. Water companies are allowed to release sewage into rivers and streams after extreme weather, such as torrential rain, and when they were close to operating capacity. This protects properties from flooding and prevents sewage from blocking up into streets and homes. Deborah, you were very vocal that we had to cover this, so I think it's only right that you get the first crack at it. And I promise that's the last I'm going to do the talking shite joke.
It's disgusting. I've been looking all day at pictures and videos of affluent discharge, and I can't even. 256 Tories voted for this amendment that made it easier, less legislation. And as you say, the interesting thing was it's meant to be emergency releases in the events of storm surges, or for a little while they were allowed to do it because they couldn't get any chemicals for treatment during the pandemic.
But England, right, we spoke about it before. Yeah.
But England right now is in a drought. So what are they discharging for? And why every single beach from, I don't know, Land's End to Hastings? I don't know. I don't know geography, England. I couldn't tell you.
Hastings is at the south coast. So Land's End to Hastings wouldn't be very far.
I don't know, very far. No. That's just one big jobby though. Yeah.
In fairness, I don't know English geography that well. I only know because of the Battle of Hastings.
So like, 1066.
They just jumped to the channel to have a fight.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's gross. And why were the Tories whipped in this issue? Obviously, there's some water companies doing a wee bit of lobbying in the background. Mm-hmm. And the next Prime Minister, Liz Truss, I sent you a wee article. Do you see how much she cut to the Environmental Protection Agency down in England? It's all looking a bit suspicious. Also, the Tory spokesman who's come out and he's saying, look, this is going to improve our water system. This is better for our... I don't think so. I think if you go and look at what the Surfers Against Sewage are saying, they kind of catch a wave with a big shite cutting the math. It's terrible. It's gross and disgusting. And I play a lot of video games. Don't know if I've told you about this before. But I particularly like role-playing games, one of which that I was really into used to be SimCity, which is like you build a city, grow it into an empire, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, one of the first rules is you'd keep all your sewage away from the humans because they don't like it. It's not as... I mean, that is really one of the first rules of civilization, and we've regressed to the point where we're like, should we maybe put this through a surface cleaning unit before we put it out into the sea? Nah, just full piss and shit right into the River Eden. I don't know if that's a river in England, but it sounds like it might be.
It sounds right. I don't know if it's true, but it sounds right.
It does sound right. Yeah, I completely agree with everything that you were just saying, particularly your love for SimCity. I haven't played SimCity since about 1999, so, and that was the old school SimCity. So,
and you know, you've got to have your yellow blocks away for your green blocks.
Exactly. And you also need to be mindful of adverse weather conditions like tornadoes and air disasters, because that can be particularly problematic in a SimCity. But moving back to sewage. Yeah, just to echo pretty much what you were saying, I think that what this kind of boils down to is privatisation of water systems in England. And I've been following this quite closely, like reading some articles from other media outlets, and Novara Media was covering this in one of their podcasts in quite a lot of detail. And basically, it was 1989 was when the English water system was privatised. And since then, there's just been legislation upon legislation that's just basically removed protections, made it easier for, you know, private companies to sell off assets and strip it full of profits and all these different things. But there's been no additional reservoirs built since 1989. I mean, if we think about some of the areas, particularly in the southeast of England, where the populations have increased, we're now facing drought-like conditions, which, you know, if you've been listening to climate scientists 30, 40 years ago, we knew that was in the pipeline. So it's, you know, handing really important public resources or public infrastructure over to private organisations to strip profit from isn't going to benefit the people who need to use those services. So now we're getting to the sort of extreme level where, you know, raw sewage has been released into rivers. And like you said before, originally this was meant to be for emergencies and whatever, which, is it great? No. But, you know, if it's an emergency, we can maybe sometimes understand why these things may need to happen, even though they shouldn't, because we shouldn't be in an emergency. But now it's just happening during drought, you know. As we start to see the climate crisis really come to the forefront, and which we've really seen, and it seems to be since we started doing this podcast, it's becoming more and more and more prevalent in various different things. So we're seeing, you know, droughts in certain parts of England. We've seen really, really high temperatures right across the UK, and we've seen water runoff as well. So we've seen really, really heavy rain and storms hit after the high temperatures, and the water is running off in certain areas. And one thing, Glenn is very passionate about horticulture, and we discuss this sometimes as well. So a point from Glenn is that, you know, because of how so much of the green belt has been moved over to residential use or commercial use and things like that, but also how we use our gardens and how we use public spaces, you know, for example, removing green spaces from your gardens, like, you know, turn it into a drive with monoblocks, things like that, that massively contributes to water runoff as well, and water not being maintained into the ground and poor drainage. So anyway, I'm going on a bit of a water spree there.
Can I just add in there, mm-hmm, just to supplement your horticultural, mm-hmm, thing? You know, drought-stricken earth, mm-hmm, it doesn't drain water.
Mm-hmm.
the same as normal Earth. When you mm-hmm. get bare Earth, it's harder for the water to drain away. So it's mm-hmm. just this vicious cycle that we're in. Mm-hmm. And they're just adding big joggies on it.
Basically, aye. So you've got this shit situation and you're just throwing shit on top of it, really. Mm-hmm. And talking about, you know, water running off certain land, you know, that is contextual depending on what areas you're talking about in the UK and what land you're talking about. But it's getting to the stage now where, you know, if we're going to face long periods without any water and things like that, they're going to have to treat the land so it can take in water. So whether that is just built, you know, digging short holes into things so water can be retained during when the soil is so hard, because I know what you're saying, that when, you know, when you've got really dry earth, it basically goes like cement and the water just runs off it. And as we, as a society, you know, go more towards easy to use gardens or monoblocking and paving and all these different things, and public areas are being converted into residential or whatever it might be, then we're just contributing to this problem, you know. So the water that, because, you know, I know in Scotland we have less of an issue when it comes to maintaining our water and keeping our water, it is in public hands, but also just because of our climate, we are fortunate in a sense that we do get more water than certain parts of England do. But particularly down in England, where you've, you know, the UK government has handed over this power to these private companies, and they've been making a fortune off the assets, off of the infrastructure. I mean, there's not millions of litres of water just wasted every day through leaks, through, you know, damaged really old infrastructure. I mean, you're mm-hmm. talking about infrastructure for about 100 years old, you know, things like that just hasn't been updated, it hasn't been invested in. And this gets to the crux of the problem that we face when it comes to privatisation, and that can be applied to all of the really important services. So from the NHS through to you know, rail, all these different infrastructure projects, that not having them in the public sector is just opening up to abuse and not servicing the needs of those who rely on those services.
I've just got to say, I think the privatisation aspect is a huge reason, because I think when we were covering this before, that we saw there was a stark difference between Scotland and England and Wales, and it was because Scotland did not privatise its water utilities in the early 90s. I think there was a move to do it,
mm-hmm.
and there was a campaign, a winning campaign, fought against it. And like you said, it's not just water, it's other utilities, other public services. At the end of the day, private companies don't really get a benefit by investing in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The benefits of that are too intangible, because they're spread out through the whole society.
Mm-hmm.
They're benefits that you see slowly and decades later. So that private companies get no interest in that. The private company is interested mm-hmm. in the bottom line, and it's interested in what their share price is today and tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens in 40 years' time just doesn't matter to them. And even if you make things that are a legal requirement, all that will guarantee is that the very minimum they can get away with, and slightly less if they think nobody's looking. Again, it's just another thing that privatisation just doesn't work.
Talking about getting away with things, the Environmental Protection Agency, because of all the cuts they've had, about half the beaches in England and Wales don't have any monitors or mm-hmm. any sort of recording devices for these discharges. So people could have been swimming in fecal matter and not even know it.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely.
And I'm just waiting on, we've had the eat mouldy food headlines.
Yeah.
We've had the hunger pangs are actually quite good for you. I'm just waiting on the next big zinger where they say, wash your clothes in urine like the Romans and help as save our sewage or some fucking fish. Like, they're really, I'm waiting on them turning this into a good news story. Sewage is actually really good for a kelp on the seafloor, or they'll come up with some fucking shite.
I'm waiting for the Sunday morning interview with Jacob Rees-Mogg, where he's trying to explain why it's not a big deal that we've got a cholera outbreak in, like, Norwich or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Again, geography, Norwich. I don't think it's on the coast. So.
Is it not?
I could have picked Blackpool. I could have picked somewhere that I know is a beach.
You could have chosen a seaside town, David.
Yeah, yeah. But no, it's true what you're saying, and And it ties in with the cost of greed, to the cost of living crisis that we're in, you know, particularly with utility companies. You know, we can see that plain as day. Everybody can see it. Everyone's impacted by it. And we can see that, you know, privatization isn't really working out for the working class. No. You know, we can see that the whole supply chain when it comes to energy is benefiting those CEOs, particularly in oil extraction and gas extraction at the moment. Basically, it's just a bad idea to have essential infrastructure, essential resources for your society to function in the hands of private companies. And now it's become just much more blatant than it ever has been. Yeah. Before, it was very subtle, and it was almost like a sort of corporate social responsibility approach for these companies being like, yes, we're doing this, we're keeping our prices low by doing this, we're keeping a great service because of this. And now actually that's just completely gone out the window, and it's becoming much more blatant. And I do believe with movements like the Enough is Enough campaign that there will start to be much, much wider resistance to these types of things. And hopefully we might start to see some shift in public policy, although I won't hold my breath under the current Tory government or the new incoming Tory government, whoever it might be, probably going to be Liz Truss. So, you know, but we shall see.
I think we'll move on to our final topic this evening. Nicola Sturgeon has described the abuse of a BBC journalist by independent supporters as disgraceful. Protesters outside the Conservative leadership hustings in Perth shouted insults, including "you're a traitor" and "scumbag rat" at BBC journalist James Cook. There was also reports of eggs being thrown and people being spat at as they arrived at the event. The First Minister said abusing journalists was never acceptable and described Mr Cook as a total pro. Deborah, what were your thoughts about that?
You came to me first for sewage, so okay. You should really go to playing next. I'm putting right. My jammies on in case you think I'm giving you a striptease. I'm not.
Ba-da-ba-ba, ba-da-ba-ba.
Right,
what's your thought?
Oh, my goodness. There's a few different layers to this, right? So you've got shouting abuse at journalists to start off with, right? When it's not abuse that is meant for that journalist is the first point, right? So they're calling the guy traitor, scum, all that kind of stuff. And all he is a BBC journalist. So I don't fully understand how we've arrived at that as much. Second of all, throwing eggs and abuse and things like that as people attend a Tory event and stuff like that. I'm no fan of Tories, right? Not at all.
Breaking news.
I'm not really a fan of the Tories. In fact, I am really not a fan of the Tories. However, throwing eggs at folk and shouting abuse at them in the street, A, breaches on invading personal space and all these different things. Not really a fan of that personally. So, and also from a more pragmatic point of view, it doesn't make your cause look very positive either. And it can potentially shut folk off, right? So that's my view on that one. And I know that the Tory scum banner was pulled out again, which, you know, clutching pearls and all that kind of stuff. Well, you know, you can certainly have that opinion. I wouldn't not disagree with it. And also, you know, there's the sort of famous case, I think it was Angela Rayner, wasn't it, from the deputy leader of Labour, was being pulled up for calling Tory scum. Well, you know, if the cap fits, sometimes people can hold those views, and that would be perfectly legitimate for people to hold those views. Would I personally say that? Depends on the context. But basically, you know, just getting back to this particular situation, right? First of all, make sure you know who you're apparently trying to abuse. If that's, you feel that that's acceptable to do that, make sure it's the right, you've got your right person. That's the main thing. Second of all, please just don't do it, right? Because it's not a positive thing to do. It doesn't help your case anymore. And if you feel really angry, okay, which is perfectly understandable under the current circumstances, the current political climate, then please apply that in a much more positive and useful way to bring about radical, progressive and inclusive change. Okay. And hurling abuse at folk, that doesn't do that. So that's my views on shouting abuse at a BBC journalist outside the Tory debate.
Deborah, what were you thinking?
Well, I don't mind the wee egging. It's a time-honoured political protest. And I'm glad we live in a country where you can still protest, because under UK legislation, our protesting rights are very much under threat. Now, would I have hurled abuse at a BBC journalist with a camera? No, Probably no, because you know what he's going to do. He's going to film it and make a story out of it. And also, James Cook isn't the worst of all the jury. I don't think he's the worst. That's who it was, wasn't it? Before he looked confused there. I don't think he's the worst, you know, biased journalist that the BBC has. I think he's all right.
There's much worse.
Exactly.
I think they probably didn't know who he was. They just knew he was a police journalist.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the egging and the spitting, I couldn't find. There was eggs in the grin. That was the only sort of evidence I could find. Could you see it? Somebody could have just trapped their messages. You don't know.
I did see a report that there was somebody threw an egg in it, but it was quite isolated. It wasn't like a whole crowd lobbing stuff, you know.
Well, I'm disappointed in that. I hope there was an egg. I choose your, as you say, Brian, if you're going to protest a journalist, then choose your, we shouldn't be protesting journalists anyway, we should be supporting them so that they, you know, do a good job. Maybe if you weren't there hurling abuse at them, they wouldn't say, oh, these guys are shouting at me, making use it to be the bad things.
And they should be held to account as well.
And for the banner, I think Tories are scum. I don't care. The continued Tory austerity has killed hundreds of thousands of people. They have affected disabled people's lives, vulnerable people's lives, making old folk choose whether to heat or eat. Fuck them. Fuck them. So what if there's a banner saying they're scum? Don't be scum. Then there will only be a banner. Sorry, is that too much?
No, I don't have an issue with the sentiment, but I think the banner belongs to Saul McGill.
Oh, fuck them and all then. I've got no time for them either.
So it's more bad. That it's their banner. I think that is more that.
Is it that stupid banner?
It's the same one.
No, I take back. I support the sentiment. Hate the banner.
I didn't really like, when I saw the videos, I thought it would, what it reminded me is the videos of the Trump rally where they all start shouting at the journalists and all that. I was waiting for somebody shout fake news, you know. I just didn't sit right with me. I didn't like it at all. I didn't like to be associated with it. It's somebody that identifies as being a member of the independence movement.
There's always been protests at Tory conferences though, isn't there?
Not always in Scotland, so it's not this idea that it's somehow just Scottish independence supporters are uniquely capable of being nasty to people, you know. There has been a lot of herald clutching from that point of view that you mentioned.
I'm sorry if I'm being really provocative. I've just got absolutely no time or sympathy for Tories right now. And I've got none.
And I think what we've identified there is that if you want to protest, then protest the problem. You know, we can definitely be critical of the BBC and their coverage of you know, the independence debate and all these different things. If you want to protest BBC journalists, you protest the BBC journalists in a way that communicates your frustrations by holding up some crap headlines that have been used in the past and saying, was this fact checked or something along those lines, making your protest actually mean something, you know, because there has been, you know, people who were editors or who worked for the BBC during the independence campaign who's come forward saying they were concerned about some of the coverage that was going out, right? Make it count. But for me personally, if you're at a Tory event and you want to, you know, channel that anger, and this is what I'm saying, it's about real genuine frustration and anger, channel it in a way that challenges the people who are attending these events. So these are members, right? These are Tory members or the hangers-ons and all these different things. Try and work collaboratively across these people who are organising things for this event to have a protest that really hits the nail on the head, whether it be the cost of living crisis, whether it be their horrendous treatment of disabled people, whether it's the horrendous treatment of older people, vulnerable people, minorities, all of these different things. If there's a coordinated protest outside these sort of Tory events, then you get your message across, you get positive media coverage, and you never know, you might actually change some people's minds that are attending that event. Again, I think if you're that deep in the Tory party that you're attending a debate for the future of the Tory Prime Minister, you're probably a bit far in to be influenced by these things. But actually, by really questioning and having a sort of coordinated and attacking way outside these events that don't, you know, put people at risk and you don't abuse them, actually you're going to make a much, much more positive impact potentially on policy, potentially on public opinion. So if you're gonna go to a Tory event and protest it, like you say, great day out. We've all been there. We've had a fantastic time, but don't abuse anybody personally. And you know, really think about what it is that you're doing and if it's going to make a positive impact and change, because that's ultimately what we want to do. Because you hurling abuse at a journalist and a couple of folk going into an event isn't going to help vulnerable people. It isn't going to help disabled people. It's not going to help old people. It's not going to help the people that need the help. So, you know, let's just channel it and make your activism count.
And also, he came over to speak to the protest.
Yeah.
You know, that was a chance to, you know, get your voice out, get something.
Exactly.
Yes.
Get something, say something. You know, and if the best thing you can say is you're a scumbag rat, well, that, I don't think that's the best use of that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Focus your anger. If you're going to lob an egg, make sure you're lobbing it at the right person.
You know, like you could have said what you were saying, Deborah, you know, why are you here protesting? I'm here because of all the crimes that the Tory party has perpetrated over the last 12 years, and then laid it out what they were. Shout you're a traitor. What does that get anybody? What does that get? All that's got is several days of bad negative headlines about how independent voters are nasty.
Yeah. And like you're saying there, if you really were passionate about speaking to that BBC journalist, and you know you're calling him whatever it was, some scumbag, whatever, then you could have said, you know, this former editor of the BBC Scotland said this about the next independence referendum. Please make sure that you and your colleagues, you should be held to accountable for those stories that were put out that were of a particular slant or a particular editorial line, and you know we're here to protest that because we were not happy about it. That's fine, you can do that, but just don't communicate that.
Aye, nobody's ever got anything from anybody by opening the conversation with "yeah, Quisling cunt." You know what I mean?
You're gonna have to put a beep in that.
Nah, I'm keeping it.
That's what editorial line says. That's fine.
Did you see anything about some of the stuff on Twitter I saw circulating? People with circulating pictures claiming the person that was shouting was that plant.
Oh yeah, I seen
Agent
that.
Provocateur. Oh,
that's that Q Alba Anon shit, isn't it?
Is that a particular account or is that like...
No.
Should be.
It's just like that QAnon conspiracy rabbit hole shite
with a
Scottish twist.
I mean, they were claiming it as if it was like this indisputable proof because they had a picture of somebody at a kind of unionist counter demo and they looked, there was a resemblance there. Could it be the same person? Maybe. But photographs are not always that accurate or give the best representation. I swear to God, I've got a book about Fidel Castro and one of the pictures, I swear to God, that it is Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson and Fidel Castro do not look that much alike, but in this picture, at this angle, with this certain lighting, you would swear they were twins. So just one random picture is no the fantastic proof that you think it is. You know, because you could find a picture where 1,000 people would look like this middle-aged, bald Scottish guy. You know, there are a lot of them out there.
What are you trying to say, like?
You're not middle-aged.
Nice.
Because you're younger than me, so I'm not going to call you middle-aged.
I was having a panic there. I was having a midlife crisis going to my middle age.
No, it's true. It's just people just get, I'm going to use this word really loosely, but get really excited about these types of things, these little hooks that they come across, and it's like, yeah, this must be true, and all my pals on Twitter are going to believe me. Just take a day off, mate.
I'm no mad at the protest, to be clear. I'm just, I think it was stupid how they approached James Cook, and like you said, they could have had an actual meaningful conversation with him. Maybe made a pal, might have followed them on Twitter.
I mean, the groups that I saw represented, Sol na Gael, Socialist Workers Party, Scottish Resistance, none of them are any group I would want to be within 1,000 miles of, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
Which is, it's strange to see the Socialist Workers Party powering about with these other groups, because when the Scottish contingent was part of the Scottish Socialist Party, they were the biggest unionists outside of the Tory party. So I find it quite amazing their transformation into radical Scottish nationalists.
It's an interesting group in general though, isn't it?
Well, that's one way.
And I say that really politely.
Well, I think we should finish it here before we go into an SWP rabbit hole. So,
Right. Your final appearance.
I know. And then just a few, like I was going to say, I just want to say something before I finish, but it's not, I'm like, I'm not indulgent and I'm not being egocentric. It's just to say, like, huge solidarity to refuge workers, particularly the Edinburgh Council refuge workers, right across the country, other refuge workers that are striking, and also the announcements today about the nursery and school workers who will be going on strike, and basically everybody who's balloting for strike, including UCU members, in the next week or so, I'll be balloting for strike action too. So, you know, just solidarity to everybody who is standing up for their rights and their pay and their working conditions. Whoop!
Mono workers!
I will echo that, despite the fact half an hour before the podcast, I realised my bin wasn't going to get empty tomorrow morning. but I will survive. I will
All right, Gloria, put
solidarity first. But again, Brian, your last show, I'm sure you'll be back as a guest at some stage. Hope everything goes great with your PhD. And when you come back, you can be Dr. Finlay, or specialist guest Dr. Finlay.
Yeah, which, you know, sounds lovely. But then it's just Dr. Finlay's casebook. So then I need to buy a VW car and carry this wee briefcase around with me. But yeah, thank you. I will miss being a regular contributor. I say regular since I've been on holiday so often recently. and I've loved every minute of it. It's been great. It's been fun. We started off basically, I think, because the first one was basically just us chatting about the election results, wasn't it?
That's
yes, with my brand new microphone that I forgot to plug in.
Yes, that's true. And then, you know, I think because it all came about really quite organically, didn't it? Because we were just like sending me messages to each other and be like, oh, should we just do something for the election results? And then we're like, oh, should we just keep it going? Should we just keep it going? And here we are, you know, what, a year and a half, year and 3 months later, you know, still going strong. And if you're a true Brian Stan on the Holyrood, you'll keep supporting the Holyrood contributors. I don't even know if I've got any stans. Nobody's reached out to
I'm
me.
I'm your biggest stan.
Oh, thanks,
I
guys.
I love you, Brian.
I know Jeannie's a big fan, so that's nice.
I like him with sexy voice. That's what she says.
I thought that was me.
I don't think it should.
I don't think any woman's ever said that.
It might be both of you. Maybe.
Maybe the boss said it, Brian. You just didn't hear.
Possibly. I don't think there's anything sexy about my voice, but there we go. Some people might disagree. Put a poll out. Let's see what people say.
The sexy poll quick.
Who's get the sexiest voice? I'm just going to end it now before this ends into something. So you can find all our... I'm getting emotional. You can find all our previous podcasts at leftungagged.org. Ungagged also produces a North American-based monthly podcast, World Beat with George Collins. You can also catch the monthly Talking Sense podcast with Kat and Erin. And if you get anything you want us to talk about, you can get us at _ungagged and put # Hollywood Ungagged in the subject line. Or you can drop us an email, ungaggedleft@gmail.com. And if you enjoyed this, please give us 5 stars on whatever podcast platform you use. And I would just like to say, although this is Brian's last show of the season, Deborah and I will be here next week with a guest contributor for our final episode of season 3, and we'll be taking a wee break, and then we'll be back with our all new lineup for season 4. So until then, we'll see you next week. Bye bye.
Bye.
Bye. Adieu, adieu, to you and you and you.